Well, I now have with me the chairman of the Board of Trustees, Mr. John Armstrong. Hey there, John. How are you?
I'm good. Should we say the actual organization that I'm the chairman of the Board of Trustees for?
You know, that's probably a good idea, unless people think that you're just the chairman of all the Boards of Trustees, you know, of of all the major corporations, Ford Motor Company. Yes, of the Magic Castle.
Yes, of the Academy of Magical Arts, the club that's inside the Magic Castle.
How does that actually line up? I mean, I know that originally that was how it was formed, I guess, whenever that Bill and Milt had gotten that started as the Academy. That's how it was filed, I guess?
Yeah, well, actually, the William Larson Sr. started the Academy of Magical Arts or really sort of made a call to make it happen, and then it sort of lingered for a while, and then in the 50s is when the club sort of formed as basically just a local thing in Los Angeles, and then when the castle opened, there was a major push to expand the club, you know, completely as a real, actual organization for the magical arts.
So before then, where did they meet before they had the clubhouse?
I think they just met at people's homes and things like that. This was back it was the 50s in Hollywood, and they're still sort of organizing, and the idea was to get as much membership as early as possible. So, like, people, there we have members who were actually got their membership in like early 60s, like 61, even though the castle didn't actually open until 63.
Yeah. What I think is interesting, you being the chairman of the Board of Trustees, first of all, I guess, is your youth. Just as, you know, Neil Patrick Harris is young as well as the president. My point being is it seems like with so many different organizations, IBM and SAM and others that seem to have a dwindling membership, and you look at their boards of directors and probably the average age is probably well into their 50s, I'm guessing, whereas that, you know, you are well known as being a card expert and just aside from being all around bon vivant, but you're also just a great magician, but you're also gotten involved with the politics of this. How did this happen?
Well, the Academy of Magic Arts is really the Magic Castle. Essentially, it's the only magic organization I ever took a very major interest in. And there's only one reason behind it, and that's because we had a clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Having a clubhouse is an actual physical location, a place where people could go and see magic. It was really important to me. The castle was very important to me. So when there was just some not good things happening, the people who were in charge at the time in the club, the way that the restaurant had actually split off was a third-party entity at that time, the way that there are certain people who were in charge of programming and everything else that were just not who I thought should be running things.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bunch of us that way. And so I ran for the trustees as the youngest person to run for either board. And just so people understand, the Board of Trustees is the board that runs the magic side of the Magic Castle. The Board of Directors, which is the money board, which is the board that has, obviously, it's the upper board. We're the lower board, they're the upper board.
Okay.
They are the ones who have the money. So they run the money, the restaurant, the bar, things like that. They're the ones who are in charge of the purse strings. We are the ones who are in charge of the magic, the lectures, the library, all that stuff that falls underneath our overseeing. So when it was originally created, the two boards were created essentially as a place for these people who they wanted to get off of the board of directors as kind of like a resting place for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the Board of Trustees was created for, that, and they were just there to oversee, you know, some things. And then as time changed, the board became more and more and more instrumental and actually important. And that's what kind of happened during the years that myself and Max Maven getting on the board was a really big change. David Riegel getting on the board of trustees made a really big change. And then finally myself. And then the three of us kind of did our best to, you know, make our voices heard. Max is always about, you know, magic first. This is going to be about magic.
Right.
And the people who are not who were in charge were not listening. And so we were constantly having to, like, beat that drum. And we, for, I don't know how to say this, but we kind of were able to get people on the board of directors then, Erica Larson, Rich Talley, who then was very, very, very heavily involved in then saying, hey, let's make this more about magic, let's change things. And we had a president resign, and Neil Patrick Harris take the presidentship over, and then start rerunning the club in a completely new direction. While that was starting, we had the fire. The fire pretty much allowed everybody to realize, oh no, what happens if this place goes away?
Mm-hmm.
We then rebuild better than ever, and then slowly put in all the pieces that we needed to do so that how everything ended up was where we are now, which is, and we are in the best financial shape and the best structural shape we have ever been in the 50-year history of this club.
So like a phoenix, it's really has risen from the ashes, I guess, after the fire.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, we, and by mismanagement of former management, in 2010, they ended a loss of almost $1 million.
Ouch. Wow.
And then in 11 and now in 12, we have not only making profits in years that, you know, even during the fire, we're doing extremely, extremely, extremely well and running things. And the members are seeing it. We did something that I thought was very important. The board of directors, they brought in a general manager who understood about, who wasn't a magician, who wasn't someone who was involved in the club. They brought in an outsider who was involved in private clubs and restaurants to oversee that operation. And then said, here's Hugh Guy, who's in charge of the restaurants and the thing, and our general manager's in Trafola, who's amazing. They say to him, okay, we're the ones talking to you about the food stuff, and if you have any questions about the magic, your bosses are these guys here, the trustees.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, all right, he basically is a slave to two masters, to two groups that tell him what to do, and he is able to do that beautifully and change, I think, the club so much for the better. We have amazing people at our staff. We have really, really, really strong employees. All the people that were really, really, really detrimental to the club, without any doing names, but who were detrimental to the club, who were staff members, were gone. And we were able to then basically go in and say, all right, let's run this place the best way we possibly can. We'll be able to make art, but have commerce come because of the arts. And we're being able to do that. And good things are happening out of the club now in ways that I can't even imagine would have been possible 4 years ago when I first got on the board.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that, because I recall so many years ago in which there was such financial difficulty. They were asking members to chip in or give $100 a piece or something, and trying to build up their membership. And then and then there was an issue, I think, of course, with the lease running out. I think with the gentleman from here in Texas, what's his name? Glover, yeah.
And the
Glover family. Now, what is the status, I guess, on that, as far as is it being leased still?
Our relationship with our landlords is actually very, very strong, from what I'm told.
Good.
As chairman of the board of trustees, I go to both meetings. I go to both the BOD meetings, and obviously I run the BOT meetings. But
mm-hmm.
I know there's only so much I'm allowed to speak about when it comes
sure.
to those negotiations. But everything is really strong, and we are... like I said, I think we're for the first time in a very long time, we're going to be able to have complete control of our future.
Well, I didn't know that the restaurant actually was operated by a third party. So they
at
actually,
one time it was.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we took it back.
Now back under the auspices of the
yep.
Academy.
Yes, it is. So we run everything now, and everything is back the way it really should have been.
Now,
we kind of had a complete restructuring from top to bottom.
Has much changed as far as membership goes? As I recall, it seemed like there was one fee that you would pay if you lived in the area, another one that if you were out of a 250-mile radius or something kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
Similar kind of a thing, I guess, different fee structure?
Yes. Yeah. It's we have a resident membership and a non-resident membership.
Okay.
Non-resident members pay far less money because we feel they're going to use the club far less than someone who
sure.
did, you know.
And membership-wise, you say financially it's doing well, so obviously the membership has been growing?
Yeah, you know, and unlike, say, an IBM or SAM, mm-hmm. our dues are pretty hefty because of the clubhouse, and also because of the fact that we have two levels of membership. We have a magician membership for people who have passed the audition and who are actually, you know, magicians in some way. And you don't have to be a performer. You can also, you know, demonstrate, you know, the magic, you know, woodworking that you do, or
be a collector.
Collector, yeah, exactly.
Right.
You can do that, historian, kind of thing. But that is one level of membership. The second level of membership is associate membership, which is just people in the Los Angeles area, or even not even in LA, like I said, around the world,
mm-hmm.
who are just fans of magic, like magic. They don't do it themselves, but they want to bring people to the club. They like the club and whatnot. So between both the associates and the magician members, we have over about 5,000 members worldwide, and it's about a 50-50 split between magicians and associates.
That's interesting, because as I recall, back in the 80s, maybe it was, as I recall, it was only about 10% or so of the were magicians, and the other 90 were non-magicians. Does that sound like that'd be reasonable?
Or maybe, I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know if I don't even know if that's even possible.
Okay. Well, it may be.
I don't think the numbers would add up that way.
Yeah, it may be just that what I was thinking is that was the approximate attendance. You know, when I first worked at the Castle and Bill Larson was saying, you know, it's not going to be all magicians. Matter of fact, that the majority, the preponderance of people who come in are non-magicians. So maybe that's what I was thinking. It's only about 10% of the people who would show up on a given night might have been.
Well, yeah, that is the case. I mean, I've said that to magicians as well, who are really afraid of just working at like a magic convention for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like that.
Right.
The majority of people that are coming in the door are either guests of the magician members or people on guest cards.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they come in on guest cards, they're just, you know, they're just there. And unlike anywhere else in the world, they had to dress up. You know, they had to get a guest card. They're on, you know, they're usually a direct guest of a member, so they're on the best behavior. They
mm-hmm.
are probably the best audience you'll ever perform for in your entire life.
I think the beauty of that is exactly what you just said there, then, John, because they will be a great audience because they come knowing that they are expecting to see magic, as opposed to going to a restaurant and some magician comes up to their table and they're going to say, what are you all about? You know, or they may have some trepidation if they're going to be going to a you know, a company party. It's like, oh, we got a magician. They don't know anything about it. You know, feel like they got to go. Whereas they actually come there to see magic.
Yeah. We're an attraction. We're, you know,
right.
And that was one of the things that was failing in the previous sort of administrations of boards, was that the people who were running it like it was a restaurant with some magic.
Mm-hmm.
That's never the way it should be. It should be we're a clubhouse full of magicians that happens to serve dinner. That's the way it has to be.
Now, about how many people would you guesstimate come in a regular evening? Let's say even the weekends, you know, when it'd be most crowded. I mean, 600 sound reasonable, or 400? I mean, what sounds like a...
Well, our max capacity is just under five.
Okay.
500 people, yeah. You know, we put 140 people into our main showroom,
mm-hmm.
The Palace of Mystery. That's our bigger showroom. 54 go into the parlor, and 20 go into the close-up room. So, and then we also have a room downstairs called the Teller that we operate on the weekends, on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, as an alternative space for people to be able to see sort of a medium-sized show, a parlor-esque type show,
mm-hmm.
And that seats 40. And that's where, if you've heard all the Derek and Helder, who now are doing the show at the Griffin, and their show started down as a Teller show. And so we've been at, it's kind of a great space because people have been coming in, creating shows just for that venue, and then hopefully, going out to with them.
And how long has the Peller been open?
That's been going on for about 3 years now.
Okay.
But just under 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, 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 I think, successful thing. And now we've been able to expand out until, it used to be just Friday and Saturday, now it's Friday and Saturday and Sunday. And we get the crowds. Our Sundays have become incredibly busy. In fact, actually, and this could be a product of an uptick in the economy. This could be, as well as, I think, just the word of mouth and other stuff. But lately, not tooting our own horns too much, but lately we have been able to have crowds on nights that you would never expect anybody at the club. We're doing amazing numbers pretty much nightly. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Fridays and Saturdays are booked up months in advance. Sundays are getting that way right now, and Thursdays is going to be the next big sellout day. So it's pretty amazing how this is all.
So you open for brunch on Sundays as well?
Sunday and Saturday, yeah. There's only one Saturday we don't do brunch, but every other Saturday is that. We don't do Saturday brunch on like the days we have a swap meet and things of that nature. But other than that, there's always a Saturday and Sunday brunch.
And I remember that they used to have the Friday member brunch or lunch. I guess they still have that.
Yep. That's still there, and I still attend every week, and this one table that just like it sits about I would say 18 people sitting around this table. We sit all these chairs and put them together, and then everyone just sits there and just shouts across each other. It's a good time.
And so, for just to kind of wrap up over here, for those who have never been to the Magic Castle and want to come over from another country or wherever, how would they go about? Who are magicians who might be listening to this and want to come, should they contact you, or is there a way they can, since it is a private club, how do they get in if they could at all?
Well, if they're a member of an outside magic organization, the Magic Circle, IBM, FAM, we've always allowed magicians to, who are members of those organizations, to make dinner reservations into the club. We feel like, you know, we're inclusive, we're not exclusive. And it's about Magic Brotherhood worldwide. So, if you call the Magic Castle at, 323-851-3313 and say that you're an IBM, FAM, Magic Circle, or any sort of magic organization that is usually sort of recognized globally. I know there's like different organizations in Asia that are not coming to my head immediately.
Right.
Member of FISM, whatever that is.
Right.
And say, you know, you want to come to dinner. You come to dinner, you still have to pay the cover charge and have dinner. You have to come in as though you're coming on a guest card. But that would be the way to actually experience it, you know, without having to
be a member.
Or just wanted to become a member, go to our website, magiccastle.com. All the information is right there. Non-resident memberships, wherever you are in the United States or the world, all you have to do is sign up and get some accredited person from your local club, like the president of your local club or whatever, to sign up, sign your form, and send that in, and that's pretty much it. I think it's going to be next year we're going to start requiring people to do, like, to film themselves doing some magic so we can actually verify them that way. But for the most part, that's that. And or if you just want to come down, every and the first Monday of the month is the auditions for the club. If you live in the Los Angeles area, you go ahead and submit your form and do it that way. So we're always looking for people who to want to join and support the place. The more you are able to use the membership, like giving out guest passes or whatever, it benefits you, and also it helps our causes that we're trying to do.
One last question that is having to do with performing there. I'm sure that those who might be listening saying, you know, with the economy being what it is and people are looking for different avenues of revenue, if you will, and so those who might want to work at the Magic Castle should contact Jack Goldfinger and send a DVD, I assume, or can you give any details on that?
Yeah, basically, if you performing at the Magic Castle means going to Jack Goldfinger. Jack Goldfinger is the our entertainment director, director of entertainment, and he's the one who takes care of all that stuff. And so the best way, obviously, is to submit video to him. So a DVD, some sort of, you know, file that is going to be sent and it can be watched. The way to submit to the castle is to show a 20-minute, no more really than 20 minutes, no less than 15-minute set of you doing a formal close-up show, parlor show, stage show. And it should be like a one-camera shoot, no edits, straight on to the performer.
It doesn't have to be high quality. It just needs to be straight video.
Doesn't have to be high quality, yeah. But the point is that if you submit a reel, like a five-minute reel, that we will just ask you for more information.
Yeah.
So don't submit the kind of thing that you're going to submit to, like, a client, you know, who you just want to, like, you know, wow and, like, book
right.
quickly. we know what we're looking for. So if you, Jack especially knows exactly what he's looking for. So if you submit something, it should just be a straight shot of you performing a formal show. You doing walk around doesn't help us. You doing, you know, you doing a trade show doesn't help us. It needs to be a formal show of you performing and getting a close up or parlor or stage. That way we can see it, and see what we're evaluating and where you might fit into the schedule. Because it's not just always about whether you're good enough to be working the club, which is a very nebulous thing. It's about how you're going to fit into that week. Mm-hmm. If Jack has people doing linking rings, you know, in one room and guys doing ropes in the parlor or whatever, and someone doing known for that, then he's got to make sure the close-up room doesn't have that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, we have to fit everything so that all the rooms that week work together, and so no one sees the same tricks, no one sees the same type of magic, and there's a big contrast between all the different performing areas, because most people who come to the club on a guest pass see one close-up show, one parlor show, and one in the stage show. And so he's got to make sure that those shows are different enough, no matter how they see it, that they're going to be able to enjoy themselves.
And Jack's contact information along with everything else is right there on magiccastle.com.
Yeah, Jack Goldfinger at magiccastle.com.
Yeah.
Spelled the way you would, the Bond villain, Goldfinger.
Right. Well, great. Thank you, John, very much for some insight and background, a little bit of history and everything. Kind of gave us the all the details I think a lot of people would like to hear and like to know. So I'm wishing you just a great Christmas season and a prosperous New Year. Sounds like you've got a good handle on things.
We're doing really well, and thank you very much. We'll hope to see you guys in the club.
Very good. Thank you, John.
Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
All right, now we've got a special guest all the way from Vancouver, Canada, my friend and yours, Sean Farquhar. Hey, Sean.
Hi, Scott. Hi, everybody. How are y'all?
I guess they're fine. I'm doing well, but thank you for asking. And on behalf of the audience, both of them, they're probably doing well, too.
Excellent.
Hey, I wanted to talk with you.
Scott, yay.
That's right. I have dozens of listeners, actually. So, listen, I wanted to talk with you today a little bit about cruise ship industry. You know, I know you have been doing ships for how many years?
Well, a little over 2 decades.
Wow. And, you know, I have talked with some guys who have been single and they've met their wives on board or whatever, or some other guys, once they've had children, they got off the cruise and moved back. And so how did you kind of coordinate your family life? I mean, I know you're close with your daughter and have a great family life. So what happened with that?
It's a great question. I have a motto of family first. Always have been, always will. When Laurie and I first started cruising, it was great. It was just the two of us, and we traveled the world. We looked at it as a great way to have vacations in between, you know, the corporate gigs and the shopping centers, comedy clubs, and we had trade shows going. And then we realized, as we were heading towards a family, that the ship was the ideal place to be. Neither of us had to make beds or cook food. Everything was just looked after right there. So Hannah was actually conceived on Norwegian Cruise Lines, Norwegian Sky. We were there for the first 1.5 trimesters and went home at the end of the second trimester so that Hannah could be born at home in Canada. And then we had to stay off the ship for 9 months until she'd gone through all those initial tests and all those shots and everything. In those months, we spent doing fair circuit and realized I didn't want to suck a lot of dirt in through my teeth on Grand Stands and went right back to the ship, lived on the Norwegian Sky until that ship ended and moved over to the Norwegian Star after that. I think we lived in the one for 5 years. It was great. She learned to walk, talk, everything. So it was the ideal situation. I only worked 1 day a week, 2 shows on that night. The rest of the week was family time. And wow. Norwegian Cruise Lines was so good to us. They gave us the opportunity to work towards the end of the week. That way we were regular family for most of the cruise. And then one night we became the stars of the ship. The next day the people got off and we started all over again being regular folks again.
Wow, so you really had an extended family with all the staff and the crew and everybody, I guess, on board there.
Speak French, German, Tagalog, Spanish very well because she had 190 family members who treated her so dearly. The amount of gifts at the end of a year we donated to an orphanage in Mexico. 4 garbage bags filled with stuffed toys that the people hit. 4 of them.
Well, let me ask you about how cruise ships have changed over the years and over the last couple of decades. I assume that you've seen it go through different tides.
Oh, yeah. It started when I first began back in the 80s. It was literally, you know, an exclusive thing for the rich. I was working on five-star ships like the Sea Goddess, Sagafjord, Vistafjord, which were, you know, all the Cunard line, QE2. And they were very high-end, and it was very expensive. And the people that went were very old. There were very few young people. Within a decade, things had changed. I was working, for Holland America, Norwegian Cruise Lines, and they were family oriented, and the prices were much more reasonable. The shows that I started with were variety shows where I was a 15-minute act opening, you know, for Cheetah Rivera or Dudley Moore. And now, the new era, I became the headliner, actually doing full evening shows of 45 minutes with Comedy and Illusion. When I started, I had like the opening spot, a 15-minute on a welcome show, a 15-minute on the closing show, the one-hour show, maybe a talk, a session, learning classes, that sort of stuff. They had so many things for you to do. Other entertainers had jobs like calling bingo or cleaning pools. I never had to do any of that. But now things have even changed again. In just the last 5 years, with the cost of fuel, they've really minimized, they started knocking back the price scale on a lot of entertainers on many of the cruise lines and making the entertainers perform more. I know on lines like Princess Cruise Lines, some of the entertainers do as many as 6 or 7 shows in a week.
Wow.
But it's to utilize their talents because they're already there. Other cruise lines have gone to flying in the act and flying them out because it's cheaper than keeping them on board and paying port taxes and freeing up, you know, cabins. It used to be 6 cabins for 6 entertainers. Now it's 2 cabins for 6 entertainers because they come in and they leave. But even more recently, within the last year and a half, cruise lines are going back to entertainment as a focal point. For the last 4 years, entertainment was just something. They were very revenue-based to survive the current economy. And so it wasn't really about, you know, what the ratings were like, was the entertainment. They were just looking to fill the time. And now they're going back to the ratings, and they're hiring great entertainers. And they're hiring top-name entertainers in our magic field. People that pop to mind are names like Michael Finney, who's just gone out on the new Norwegian Epic, and I understand he's just signed an agreement to go out on their brand-new ship coming out soon called the Breakaway. Jeff Hobson's out there working now. That wasn't the time. You know, it used to be just the Sean Farquhars. I was, you know, not a big name in magic, still not, but it wasn't a big name. I was a guy who was working, and it wasn't considered a great job. Boy, people looked down and said, oh, you're a cruise magician. I guess you can't get a job. So, and yes, there are hacks out there doing, you know, just generic stuff. And I do my share of generic stuff done differently. But that used to be looked at differently. Now, you know, wow, cruise gig is a great gig. I worked in some of the best stages I've ever worked in my entire life, or on a theater in a ship. When I first started on a bandstand with a 12-piece Polish orchestra standing behind me pointing at how the gimmicks were.
Well, you know, something that has changed a little bit from what you said there, it sounds like that you used to do, and still do occasionally, I guess, large-scale illusions and box tricks and everything. But a couple of guys you mentioned, I know Michael and Jeff, obviously doing a rope and an egg bag, you know, basically, and just kind of carrying everything in a suitcase, and there you go. They've got 2 or 3 acts.
Yeah, the big box guys, they've kind of been taking off ships in a way. There's a few out there, but there were guys I had 9 illusions one time in the show. Greg Gleason was on the Norwegian Jewel forever. That was his ship, I think, for well over 5 years. And he was making helicopters appear and all sorts of amazing stuff. But that's very expensive to ship out and to return. That guy gave you the opportunity to have a longer-term contract. But they've realized that, you know, you can be funny and not have to pack as many props. They can fly them in and out, or they can leave them sitting there, and they're more mobile. They relate better. It's not great for an international audience, but a lot of cruising has become regionalized with the fear and the terrorism and things like that. Less cruise ships are going to far away, distant places, and more cruise ships are sailing the Caribbean, Alaska. Even less are going towards Mexico now. They're changing where they go. Turkey seems to be a safe destination.
That's interesting. You know, I had talked with an agent about some cruise ships. I had been doing a few myself, and then one guy had gone to another company, and he was saying, you know, I'm now booking comedians. He said, if you can send me a DVD that show just strictly comedy and little or no magic, he said, I could probably book you doing more ships. So, again, it kind of seems like that, you know, they're looking for younger singers and dancers. You know, Dancing with the Stars is popular, and America's Got Talent, so they want people who are, you know, kind of hip with that kind of a thing and can pack light.
Oh, yeah, the old adage still plays big. That's more funny, more money, more yucks, more bucks. they really want, they want you to be able to fly on and off. I work on cruise ships still. I work for Disney Cruise Lines now, and I do periodic contracts to fill times when I'm not as busy. And it's all fly on, fly off. And Disney's got a very clever idea. They fly me on in the middle of a cruise and fly me off in the middle of a cruise. So I work two cruises in 1 week, and I love it. Everything fits into one Black Pelican case. I carry my one suitcase with my costume, a few extra little sundries, and I'm ready to go out there and do my, you know, 30-minute show.
Let me ask you something, then, as far as how compact that your act is. You know, it seems like I recall Johnny Ace Palmer trying to do some cruise ships, of course, with just a close-up act after he had won FISM, but I don't know that that got to be a very successful venue for him. And him being at the top of his game, the top of the world, and, you know, won the FISM, et cetera, and that if, I'm just wondering if that is something that you think that ships might be interested in the future. In other words, if somebody's a close-up guy, do you think that they'd have a chance working on a cruise ship?
Technology has changed the playing field. Of course, you have a chance. When I left, I was doing a one-hour close-up show for 1,200 people in the Stardust Theater every week, and it was probably the best-received show I've ever done. Greg Gleason goes out and works on a number of cruise ships doing that. Rich Block even has a program out there for close-up magicians now, working for Crystal Cruise Lines. So there is plenty of opportunity for close-up magicians to work in a larger platform area. You can't do a close-up show like you'd normally do it. You have to design it to be seen by hundreds of people, but it's totally possible.
And they have a camera, I guess, with a monitor and all that.
I had a 40-foot by 60-foot screen and two high-definition cameras with trained professionals working them, mm-hmm. and it was a great show. It's just you have to then build your magic more for television than for close-up. I would bring people up, set them around a card table, and perform for them while everybody else got reactions and got to experience it. But at some point, you have to address the audience as a whole and present close-up magic that can be seen, you know, to the masses. But yeah, I think that technology has really changed the ability for the close-up performer to be a stage performer doing close-up magic.
So you don't think necessarily that means that there will be a close-up magician going around during the meals, during lunch and dinner or anything like that? You're talking about actually taking close-up to the stage.
Yeah, I am. There are close-up magicians going table to table. Carnival Cruise Lines hires them right now. They're usually coming from countries less fortunate than, you know, we in North America.
Countries, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And they're paid considerably less. What we'd make in a week, they make in a month. But there are young aspiring magicians who are breaking away the bonds of where they live and are doing what they love and making money at the same time. Kudos to each and every one of them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me just kind of conclude this with where you think that the direction of cruise industry is going to be going as it would affect magicians.
Cruising is building, and magic will always be a part of cruising because it's a universal entertainment that transcends language. The ships are getting bigger. The stages are getting bigger. The new Norwegian Cruise Line's Breakaway, it's so big I think they'll be able to swing it end for end and visit island to island. You'll just walk from one end to the other. They're massive. And as long as magicians are smart and they remember that entertainment comes first, we'll always have a place there. I have friends like Kieran Buffer, who's, to me, the best cruise director on the face of the earth, and he says that he never gets better results than when he has a great magician. Magic always will have a future there. And the clever guy who's willing to fit into what's needed for a ship and can adjust to the lifestyle can have a very long and fruitful career.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for your words of advice and your look back and look forward. And
thanks.
I look forward to seeing you again over at 4F next year and have a beer together.
Yeah, as long as things don't go bad on December 21st, I'll see you next year at 4F.
Well, that's kind of the reason I wanted to get this out, you know, kind of the apocalypse edition of the magic word here.
I think it's awesome.
Who knows?
Exactly.
Well, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you and your family there, Sean.
All the best to you, too. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas.
Well, my guest right now with Penguin Magic is Tim Trano. Hello there, Tim.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. Thank you also very much for being part of this end-of-the-year pot, into the, I guess, world. The apocalypse is coming, you know, at least for the Mayans, huh? So
I'm honored to be on here, and I spoke to Ajar, who owns Penguin, the other day, and he was excited about it, too. So thank you for having us.
You are welcome. And the reason I wanted to talk with you was just about that, about Penguin, because that Penguin has kind of changed their format, if you will, or I guess business model. It seems like the Penguin has been around for a while, but over the last at least few years that I've noticed that they tend to be more of the digital age and really trying to focus more on the youth.
Yeah, I think the audience is pretty varied. I mean, the thing that's exciting to me, I worked for Murphy's as the product, new product purchaser for about 12 years and just recently shifted over to Penguin. And it's really exciting because it's kind of on the forefront. I think we're trying a lot of new, interesting things. And I think it's not just youth. I think that's the misconception. I think it's really just, it's a wide audience. Right now, we're just trying to look at where are people with attention span, with social media, with how they want information, and looking at all of those and applying it to the magic market. So there's a lot of exciting, really game-changing things going on, and I think that that's crucial.
Now, does Penguin, well, I know Murphy really is a jobber, and Penguin is a retailer, but do they also work as a jobber and or wholesaler?
Yeah, the difference is Murphy's is a wholesaler, which means that they sell to the dealers, and Penguin's, and they don't sell to end consumers. Penguin is a retailer, meaning that it sells to end consumers. Now, we own some of our own products that we also do sell occasionally to other select dealers, but the majority of our business is just retail.
Okay, and how? And obviously, this is an online, digital type of a retail operation. Let me talk a little bit about the brick and mortar shops. I mean, that's something that over the years we've kind of seen where that there have been a decline of brick and mortar shops, or else that they've had to expand to include, you know, Halloween costumes or adult novelties or whatever. It used to be, gosh, years ago that if you wanted to find a magic shop, it was kind of in a more seedy part of town even, and they always had a back room with, you know, adult things, you know, over there as well. Anyhow, over the years, that with the increase of the internet, more people have been able to sell things online just out of the garage or drop shipping like that. Have you noticed that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, both in my capacity from when I was at Murphy's and even now at Penguin, is, you know, anybody can open up a shop, but I think that it's not necessarily in everyone's best interest to do that, meaning an internet-based shop. I think just slicing up the pie is not a great thing. I do love to see really true people that are serious about it and make something of their business. I think that's really exciting for everybody. It's really exciting for the magic industry. When I see Penguin or Illusionist or Theory 11 really do great things, it's exciting because it's like they're knocking it out of the park and they're making lifetime customers from great customer service, from exciting things they're doing. That's really good. And likewise, brick and mortar shops, it's a harder thing because you have to get the people in the door. You have to have the foot traffic, and more just in everyday life, we shop online, so that's kind of just where things naturally are progressing to. But certainly, brick-and-mortar shops have a big advantage because they can create a sense of kind of like family if they do it right. And there are some shops that are really doing it right, which is exciting. So that's a big benefit brick-and-mortars have over internet-based, is that it's easier to kind of create that sense of family, of, you know, that you really know the guy and see him face to face.
You got a good point. You know, that's one of the things that I always enjoyed about the brick and mortar shop, of actually physically going down there and hanging out at the shop and some other magicians coming in, you trade ideas. It was just kind of, I guess, the old Cracker Barrel kind of a thing where you, you know, sit around and trade ideas or whatever. It's like sessioning, you know, and that is one thing that is difficult to do through an online shop, obviously. However, that they seem to have created a lot of these guys who are doing it successfully, as you said, through other social media by having a Facebook page, you know, where people can kind of interact. Say, hey, I just bought such and such, and this is really a killer trick or whatever. Of course, you know, sending out tweets and then having forums, online forums, you can trade ideas, or here is something that is a variation on this particular trick, or here's another way of using this prop or whatever.
Yeah, and I would agree. I mean, I think that's been something that in particular I've seen with Penguin, and I'm really proud about, and also proud about some of the things we have coming in that kind of thinking, that way of going. But also, you know, Illusionist has done a great job with that Theory 11 does, where it's like, let's create more of a sense of community. This is not just mm-hmm. about next new product, next new product, next
right.
new product. It's about creating kind of a sense of family. Like, you know, I hear a lot of times now people saying, oh, I buy everything through Penguin. I love you guys. I love the extra things you're doing. It's so fun. It's great. And I love to hear that. That's exciting. And we're trying to really create even more of that. So,
one of the things I've noticed over the past year or two, probably been doing this for a lot longer, but at least my observation of it has been the digital downloads. Of course, over the last several years, there have been more of the single trick DVDs that have been coming out rather than, it's just like the old albums or CDs that had a lot of music on it, and then it got so that you just download one song from iTunes that you happen to like from that CD or something, or a popular hit or whatever. So it's gotten to be the same way with digital downloads of particular tricks, that you can learn this trick. And I know Penguin seems to be excelling in that. And have you noticed that there has been an uptick over the last few years in those kinds of digital sales?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's a few factors. Number one is attention span. People, you know, this kind of goes to the single focus trick. I mean, people are so inundated with information throughout the day, from texts,
mm-hmm.
from emails, from phone calls, from whatever, that they want, it's harder and harder to sit through two or three or four volumes of something. They really want somebody to have selected the best stuff. So I think people's attention span is a big factor. I think also people want stuff right away, and instead of waiting 3 days or 5 days for the DVD to show up, they just want to be able to hit a button and have it there.
Right.
And, you know, they also want to be in control. It's like now my wife and I, as an example, we very rarely watch TV. We very rarely watch DVDs. We'll find a series we like on iTunes, we'll download it and watch it. And that way we can watch it if we're on a flight somewhere. We can watch it, you know, at the airport. We can watch it if we're walking on the treadmill at the gym, anywhere. So it's now on our time as opposed to being on somebody else's time. And so just, I think, as a market, we, meaning Magic, have to really look and say, what is the consumer demanding? What are they wanting? And more, I think people are wanting downloads and digital content, even in e-books. I hated e-books, but a year ago, I just got addicted, and you start buying more and more. And although I love the book now, if I could have everything on my iPad, it's just so much easier, so much more searchability. And I just carry this little tiny tablet around, and I have access to thousands and thousands of pages of information.
It is handy. You know, all those reasons and more, I think, are kind of where people are right now. Certainly short attention spans, the ability to carry it around with them in whatever kind of digital format they want to have access to it immediately. I think that is kind of where we are right now. Well, looking forward, where do you think people are going to be going? What is your idea? You think it'll be more of that kind of thing? Or, you know, what's the next best thing that you think?
Boy, that's the million-dollar question. I think we all wish we had the answer to.
Sure.
But I think it will just kind of go more. You know, Magic tends to be more behind the time than other fields. And,
really?
So I think so in a lot of ways. I mean, there's some ways maybe.
See, I would thought just the opposite. It's always been that Magic has been at the forefront of technology, you know, let's say like with movies or something, you know, or whatever it is, or, you know, like with Jean-Robert Houdin with electromagnetics or whatever it happens to be that's new that no one knows about. If you're using sophisticated technology, it will seem as if it's magic. I think someone said something like that before anyhow. But you see, my point, I think, is that we try to use the newest technology. And that's why there were a lot of things that were available, like for the iPhone or iPhone. touch or whatever, you know, when they first came out, that were all kinds of tricks because you could do things, and they used to be, they were cool. Then before long, before a short time actually, people said, not only is that cool, but hey, where did you get that app? It's not like you did it, but the app did it, you know. Yeah. So,
well, and I think you're right, but it's interesting because I think if it's a technique for a trick, we're probably looking more ahead of the pack than most people, just because that's what's interesting to us.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting to most of the magic market. But the people that are producing things, the magic market is and actually even probably the magic consumers are probably behind the eight ball compared to the rest of the market. You know, as an example, I remember when there was kind of this transition period of video going to DVD, and people thought, oh no, it's not going to happen. And and already you had started seeing outside of magic DVD sales, you know, growing and growing and growing. And, you know, I remember the big shock when finally, I think it was maybe L&L Publishing said, we're not even going to do this one in video. We're just going to do it in DVD. And everybody was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
But for the rest of the world, that was already happening. So I think you're right as far as the technology to achieve tricks, but probably not as far as the technology to provide information.
Oh, provide information. I see where you're going with that. Yeah, exactly.
So that's something that we're looking at. And we're looking at, you know, personally at Penguin, one of the things that I'm real excited about is we want our customers to feel like they're part of the team, like that this is more than just coming in and shopping and going home with some tricks. We want to really do some hand-holding, give them a place where they feel really great, where there's exciting, fun things, interesting. And
so what are you doing to facilitate that?
You know, a lot of stuff, even the look of just the site. You know, I got to be honest, when I originally saw it kind of go to this cartoony type of thing, I talked to Ajar. This was long before I was working with Penguin. And, you know, Ajar had some really great, solid reasons for going there. You know, everything from, not vanity is too strong of a word, but appealing to people, for lack of a better word, appealing to the artist's vanity. I mean, in the fact that they're kind of captured in these funny, interesting cartoons, all the way to making it feel like a fun place. You know, when you go in, it's just a fun, interesting thing. You know, it's not.
It draws you in more, yeah.
It's not dark. It's not daunting. It's just like, here, come on in and have fun. And so there's that. We're doing the live lectures, and we're trying to promote that even more because we're bringing in some of the top talent in the world, really. And I think it's far, even now, even though it's been very successful, it's far underutilized, and we want to get word out more that, you know, here's a chance to watch some of the best people in the world do lectures, either live or you can go back and download them later and watch them. And there's some really amazing, amazing stuff. And the price is just super cheap, and I'm not trying to, it sounds like the sales pitch, but the idea is that, you know, even for us, as long as we're giving this really great thing, you know, at this point, it's certainly very successful, but it's not anywhere where it could be. But we want to just give something really special to our customers and have an exciting place to be.
Well, it sounds like that you have achieved your goal, because I've visited that site, and I've purchased a lot of things through Penguin as well. So,
thanks. And, you know, there's a long road ahead, and I think that's one of the exciting things. I mean, there's a few dealers, you know. Well, there's a lot of dealers, you know, Penguin,
sure.
Illusionist, and Theory 11, and Hocus Pocus, and a lot of guys really trying to do, kind of step up the game and make it better. And that's really exciting. I mean, you know, you can look at that as, oh, there's competition, but I don't look at it as that because I think we all have our own customers. I look at it as a really great, exciting thing for Magic. When I see another dealer do a good thing, it creates, you know, lifetime magicians, as I said before, and a lot of those new magicians have great, wonderful ideas that we may not have been exposed to. So I think it's a really exciting thing. I would love to get more back to more of a brotherhood in magic, as opposed to, you know, one of the downsides of the technology age is that sometimes it's easy to hide behind these chat boards and websites and be really negative.
Be anonymous, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that that's too bad. It's unfortunate. It's short-sighted and kind of petty. And I think it's far better to use these really wonderful resources to have strong, interesting discussions that take magic forward instead of cutting each other down or cutting down creativity or whatever. I mean, it's really easy to say, oh, I hate something. It's really hard to say, this is how you could make it better. And one is just a lazy way, and one is a much more thoughtful, productive way.
That's the difference between criticism and constructive criticism, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's really, you know, I work with some of the top producers in the world, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard them get discouraged from going on some of the boards and having their new creations kind of just lambasted. Mm-hmm. And I think it's okay to be critical. I mean, I have personally very hard discussions with some of these guys because that's part of my job, but it's always constructive criticism to try to achieve something that's better. And that's really important. But just to get on there and say, I hate something or that's stupid, it doesn't do anybody. It
doesn't serve a purpose, yeah.
Exactly.
Other than just a forum for that person to stand on a soapbox and beat their chest and feel like they're somebody by criticizing something.
Yeah, and so I'd love to see, and I don't know if that's going to change anytime soon, but I think if we can at least think about that, if we can call a spade when we see that,
mm-hmm.
And hopefully we'll get enough positive stuff going forward. And we're going to just, you know, at Penguin, what we're trying to do is really create some situations where we have teams of people working to give positive direction, to help artists, to help magic, to help the customers. And I think that that's really exciting.
Well, that sounds great. Let's just leave it there. I think you can't say anything more than that. I think that's kind of our wish for the future, so that way that we have more of a brotherhood of magicians that are helping each other than two.
Yeah, and, you know, hopefully that doesn't sound too altruistic, but I think it's a much more positive thing, and I think just by us having these discussions is a good thing. So I appreciate the opportunity to do that and doing all the great things you're doing, Scott.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. I appreciate it, and I wish you and your family Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Same to you. Take care.
Thanks a lot. And now live from Las Vegas, I have Murray Sawchuk. Hey there, Murray.
Hey, Scott. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
You are welcome. I'm glad to have you as being the representative from Las Vegas on this end of the world apocalyptic broadcast I'm going to be doing here.
Very exciting. I can't wait. You may be my last interview I ever do.
I was going to say this may be the last one that anybody hears. Yours may be the last voice they hear, you know.
Wow, that's sad. That's a shame. That really is a shame. That means everyone lost a bet.
For those of you, obviously, who are listening to the podcast, you might recognize Murray's voice, of course, as being one who was on America's Got Talent and have seen him. You went through several weeks, I think, of that. I think you kind of gotten to near the finals there, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to the finals position and was like the top 12 on the whole show and a couple of years ago. So it was pretty amazing, managing a train and doing all the other stuff we did on the show. So it was wonderful.
All of that amazing stuff. And then, of course, working with Celebrity Cadaver and all kinds of stuff that you've been involved with on television over the years.
Sure. And the Pawn Stars. You know, that's my last one. That's the latest one I'm on now.
So. Oh, that's right. The Pawn Stars.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Exactly. And for those, by the way, who are outside of the U.S., that's PAWN, Pawn Stars, which is about pawn shops.
Yes, exactly. You do not, do not misspell that, because if you do, it's a completely different website.
Exactly. Be a different Murray they might find there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And so I wanted to talk with you again as being a representative kind of Las Vegas, because that is the showroom of the world, and everybody likes to go there for vacation as well as being a hub for magicians. A lot of guys had kind of migrated from Los Angeles over to Las Vegas some many years ago, first thinking, I guess, they were going to be in Hollywood, and then after Siegfried and Roy broke that curtain in order to allow magic to be popularized in Las Vegas, a lot of guys moved in over there. So I'm assuming there still are just a whole heck of a lot of magicians in Las Vegas.
Yeah, there's lots of magicians, you know, but if they don't realize, you know, what Siegfried and Roy did for the industry here, most of these people think they can fly in, they being on a cruise ship or amazing in their small town, or they've won a couple of awards, and they can just walk in and all of a sudden be Siegfried and Roy because now Matt is accepted here. And they don't seem to realize that Siegfried and Roy, you know, worked a lot as a variety act on a small spot in the Folies Bergère, over at the MGM Grand in that show. Then they moved, you know, the Stardust, then the Frontier, and then the Mirage, which was the huge highlight of their career. And, you know, speaking to Siegfried, you know, it's really funny. He's like, you know, you young guys just want it tomorrow, all like that. He says, when I came to Vegas, I was old. When I retired in Vegas, I was old. You know, so, you know, it takes a lot of work, you know. And they start on the ships, and they have their hook with the Tiger and the Cheetah and all that. So it was a process, and people don't realize that. Same with Wayne Newton. He started singing at 13, you know, in the small clubs doing, you know, six sets a night in a lounge. I mean, that's what he was. He was a lounge singer, you know, and people don't realize that's how he became who he was. It's you know, trials and tribulations.
Well, now, how can somebody make it, quote, make it, I guess, in Las Vegas? I mean, do they need to start out, like, in a small showroom or maybe kind of work with the band and the lounge act or something and then eventually four-wall that? I mean, or how, what would you suggest?
I think it's a game. I think you have to pay your dues. You know, I think, you know, you can come in and drop a ton of money and have a theater and have billboards. I mean, anyone can do that anywhere. If you have the money, you can have your show at a theater and you can have billboards. But you got to remember, you got to sit back and be a little critical and go, why would they want to see me? Great, somebody's good looking, or great, you're talented, or great, you have an illusion that there's only five in the world of. But why, when you look at the billboards, there's Shania Twain, Celine Dion, Barry Manilow, David Copperfield. They have a reason to be seen. They've been on TV, they have a track record, and they do put on a great show. So when you come to Vegas, why would they want to come see you? Have you been on a TV show? Are you recent? Are you current in the news?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has to be a reason, because remember, if you're in your small town, and there's a couple of theaters, well, you can probably draw people for a weekend or two because it's something different and unique. Here, you are coming to 120 shows an evening in Las Vegas. That's
wow.
Your competition. So, if you want to make it somewhere, go somewhere where there isn't anybody else, so you can be the best in that category. But here, even if you are the best magician, there's still another 118, 110 shows that are still phenomenal, from singers to acrobats to jugglers to comedians. You know, so you're really putting yourself in the, you know, a really tough boxing ring with a lot of good fighters. You know, so that's the difference.
That's true. You know, I think that it's hard, though, to try and find the kind of venue or a city or location where there are people, it's a destination city, if you will, like Las Vegas is, where people come to see entertainment and to be entertained. Specifically, only a few come to mind that would obviously be like Atlantic City or Branson, Missouri. Perhaps, I guess, maybe that if what you're saying, people should kind of scale back and maybe start to pay their dues in smaller towns like Biloxi or someplace, working some smaller casinos, if that's what they want to do.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I started in Atlantic City. The Showboat was my first casino. And I went overseas to Japan and China and all sorts of places. So, you know, when you hone your skills, you figure out what's unique about yourself, and now you have a bit of an angle. You know, for me, I was lucky because I've done, you know, over 12 reality shows on TV. So that's where my pull is. And then I you know, got a unique character I've built over the, you know, the last 10 years. And for a lot of magicians, you know, who don't know me, you know, that's the CDA. I started within the business. I retired that like 5 years ago, and it's all been, you know, very comedy based, very Dennis the Menace kind of magic stuff,
mm-hmm.
which I, you know, enjoy. You know, very Ballantine-esque type stuff. You know, but that's what keeps you on TV, because you know, you sell yourself as a personality and not just a box pusher. So that's a big difference.
That's a very good point. You know, I think that was, for an example, Kevin James had a business plan in mind when he was on America's Got Talent. It wasn't so much moving forward as it was to exactly be seen so he could put, quote, butts in the seats. And if people had seen him on television and on a popular show like AGT and like with you, then people are going to come in. I mean, right now you're starring in the Tropicana over there and
yeah.
Bringing in crowds. I've seen the show. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
If you guys get out to Vegas,
well,
you need to be able to see that. It's really good.
Yeah.
I know you're competing with the other 119, you know, shows out there every night then, too, so it's got to be tough.
Sure it is, you know what I mean? And, you know, what's funny is my stronger days are weekdays, not weekends.
Huh.
And people think, well, Friday, Saturday, people come in, they've got a day at night off, why wouldn't they come see you? Well, most people who come to Vegas, they already have their big ticket item already to see. Whether it be a Cirque du Soleil show for $125 for the ticket, or
right.
Celine Dion, Shania Twain, Garth Brooks, whomever is in town, they already go, hey, we're going to Vegas, we have our one show we're spending a fortune on, but we've got another couple days there, so what are other shows that are more reasonable, maybe get two for one so that we can see?
Yeah.
And that's the space I fill in there, Barry Manilow or Shania. So that's the niche, and you really got to be real with yourself. You know, it's great to go home and win an award or see yourself on TV and think you're the greatest. We've all done that. But you really got to be real with where you sit in the market. And I'm a Sunday through Thursday show, meaning people are walking along going, wait a minute, I've seen that guy somewhere. He might be a fun show. Well, for 30, 40, 50 bucks, you know, worth going to see. 120, I don't want to take a risk. I'd rather go see a name like Shania that's been around for 15 years, you know. So you know, that's what you see yourself in the business.
That's a good point. And it seems like you and I talked about this some time ago, and that is that once you put out the billboards and you've got the signs in the backs of the taxis and flyers and you put yourself in the Vegas
sure.
magazine, et cetera, that's all well and good because when people are going to be coming in, it's like they haven't heard of Scott Wells. I mean, if I'm there or something.
Yes.
However, all of a sudden they start seeing all these signs and billboards and everything. It's like, maybe I may need to go see this show. However, I think as you had pointed out, that when you literally go outside the city limits, suddenly that name is gone again. It's like you're nobody outside of that little fishbowl, if you will. But it's a huge fishbowl.
It's true.
But
it's true. There's a place called Henderson, literally, you know, 5 miles from Vegas. Trim is about an area, I know, about 20 miles out of Vegas. And it's a big joke, you know, Danny Gans, who is an impersonator, used
yeah.
to be with The Wind, he passed away recently, and then Terry Fader's kind of filled his spot. Now, Terry had the success of America's Got Talent, but that was
right.
quite a few years ago. But there's, you know, I've always told people, you know, outside of Prem, nobody knows who Danny Gans is. Phenomenal act. Amazing. But you can be a star in Vegas and just live your life and feel great about your show, and you don't have to go anywhere when you have a hotel backing you like Danny Gans did and like Terry Fader. But then you want to go do a gig in New York or somewhere else, so like, you know, who are you? You know, and it's interesting.
Right.
You can really get caught up in believing you really are more famous than you are. And then a perfect example is I went to the charity last weekend in Arizona with Alice Cooper. And the stars, it's called the Christmas, the charity for his Solid Rock Foundation, where he takes kids off drugs and drinking and gives them a guitar or a piano or a dance lessons, kind of trades it in for a talent.
Cool.
And he's been around for 12 years. And he brings stars in every year, various ones called Christmas pudding, as a pudding is filled with different things. So every year it you know, promotes this Solid Rock Foundation. Well, I went there and I host the event. It's my third year doing it. And, the stars they had that this year was Johnny Depp, Don Felder, who wrote Hotel California from the Eagles, L.A. Gunn, Sebastian Bach from Skid Row, you know, Orantia, which is, you know, Michael Jackson's guitar player from
wow.
This Is It tour he's gonna do. So, when you walk into that environment, and Live Nation was, you know, producing the show and putting it together, which is the number one touring, you know,
yeah,
company
know,
for
Live
big
Nation.
Shows.
Mm-hmm.
And when you walk in to do a show like that, they're real stars. There is a big difference. I mean, all of a sudden you sit around with friends who've got notoriety or on the cover of a Magic magazine or something, and yeah, they're stars in their own right.
Right.
But then you walk into a venue and you're working with legends, you know, Johnny Depp, Alice Cooper's, and that
A-list
is a star. You know, and it really puts things in perspective, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's very different, you know.
Exactly. Well, let me conclude, I guess, over here with what you think is going to be happening in the future. I mean, certainly that Las Vegas is having to reinvent itself all the time. And, you know, hotels come and go, and they tear down one and build another one. I know that there has been an issue, of course, I guess, with Lake Mead and the water level going down and having less water available
oh, yeah.
for electricity and kind of, you know, the future, you know, 15 years from now, will they be able to keep on the lights in Las Vegas? But as far as kind of the next few short years, do you kind of see things continuing to be a big push and Magic in particular being a part of it?
Yeah, I think Magic is going to be a huge push in Vegas. I think Magic will always be in Vegas because it's kind of like Disney World without the Magic. I mean, that's what Disney World, Disneyland, Walt Disney created, you know. You may have your weak times in the year or weak years that Disney doesn't put out certain movies, but at the end of the day, Magic drives it. And I think because Vegas is such a surreal place, people come here from the middle of Iowa,
right.
Oklahoma, you know, Boston, Mass., to be a little more relaxed, a little let loose, and they can do whatever they kind of want to do and enjoy what they want to do because they're not being judged so much. Because we just go, oh, it's Vegas, you know, and then you hop in a plane, you go back home and live your life.
Right.
And I think Magic invites itself. You can go see a Magic show and pretend not to believe, you know, or believe for an hour and a half, you know, and it's a fun place to do that. Where certain places may not accept it as much. Where, say, in Chicago, you want to see a Jersey Boys or a symphony orchestra or a ballet. Well, Vegas, you can kind of just go see random shows that you probably wouldn't see in your hometown because you're here just to kind of, you know, see what's out there.
Or wouldn't
so
even be available
be
in your hometown. Wouldn't even be available in your hometown.
No, exactly. I mean, certainly some of these shows can't even tour. I mean, O, which is the water show of Cirque du Soleil,
right.
It can't alone in Vegas. Would take, you know, a year and a half to build in your hometown, you know, and they couldn't tour. So there's certain shows that can't do that. So I think, you know, yeah, with the water level and with the way Vegas is, everyone who lives here, it's a different world because water's piped in. necessities are made here. You know, it's you know, like just made all over the world. But I mean, without Hoover Dam, we're a pretty starved city. So it's one of those things where, we pray for rain. I mean, today it's raining, ironically. The first rain day we've seen for years, or months, actually. And it's a different, style of living. You know, when you have a house, you buy water-saver faucets. You don't have a strong pressure on your water. You know, I'm from Canada, where water runs freely all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, it rains 10 months a year.
Yeah.
So it's a different standard of living. You got to have a little more respect for the environment here. And it's one of those things where it's a tourist town. So when you're driving everywhere, you know, you've got to deal with a different mentality, people looking up, stopping when they shouldn't be stopping, and living a little differently because they're here to see the spectacle, you know.
Right. Well, Murray, thank you very much. I appreciate your insight and kind of telling us a little bit about the past and the future.
Sure.
What's going on right now, kind of the Vegas buzz. And is there anything, by the way, that is, as far as speaking of buzz, that's happening right now?
Sure.
Or something before the end of the year that people need to see or do?
Well, you know, in Vegas, there's always things new every year happening, you know what I mean? With new stars coming in, things changing, you know. Right now, the new thing here is obviously Shania Twain, the Coliseum, a singer, you know, and of course, Tim Faith Hill. But magic-wise, it's pretty normal, you know. Copperfield's still here, Chris Angel's still doing his stuff, Matt King's still here, you know, there's Jan Roven, and there's Seth Grables, and a bunch of different magicians in town, and Mike Hammer downtown. Everyone's, you know, doing different things. Ironically, we're all kind of friends in indirect ways, because I think we have our own personalities.
Right.
You know, and for me, on the New Horizon, I just shot a couple more Pawn Star episodes, because they're going to be airing in the early new year. And I just got a call. I'm going to be filming with Hallmark, the Hallmark channel, on the Home and Garden show, because what people don't know about me is on the weekends, I landscape. I absolutely love it. I've been doing it for years.
Cool.
So I'm going on that show, bringing a little bit of magic to the gardening world, and we're kind of having a crossover, a magical garden transformation. So that's going to be airing probably January 2nd, and then January 28th, I'm going to be on Let's Make a Deal with Wayne Brady, and then
yeah,
in February on Top Gear. So it's going to be a fun beginning of the year.
That's good. Well, you've kind of got a good handle on marketing yourself, certainly, because, as you said, people need to see you and know the name, so that way it's like, oh, yeah, I've heard of that guy. I need to go see that show. So one thing
kind of helps
the other.
Oh, it's true. It's true. And I told everybody, you know, it's like Marvin Roy taught me, you know, Mr. Electric, you know, I'm 90%, you know, publicity and 10% talent, you know. And it's one of those things where, you know, you can be amazing. You can be the best in the world. But if you're stuck under a rock, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't really matter. You know, you have to let people know that you're amazing, you know, without being too cocky or egotistical. It's a very fine line, you know.
Right.
But that's what it's all about. You got to have that balance. And there's so many musicians that won't take the commercial route, which is fine. And I respect that as an art form, but at the end of the day, you know, we got to pay the mortgage too and, you know, have a life if we want to stay in the business.
Exactly. Well, let me wish Merry Christmas to you and Chloe, and also a most prosperous New Year.
Thank you. Well, Merry Christmas to you. Thank you for having me on your show, and we'll talk to you in 2013, hopefully.
All right. Yes, exactly. Hopefully this will continue on this planet. Thanks again, Murray.
For sure.
Okay.
Thanks.